a discussion with a top-level Pentagon official about his favorite music and how it intersects with his work in national security. Today, February 6th, 2023. Good morning, Early Birds. I'm Jonathan Lehrfeld, and this is the Early Bird Brief, produced by Defense News and Military Times. For today's episode, Military Times and Defense News Editor-in-Chief Mike Gruss talked at the Pentagon with U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kahl about his top 40 music albums of 2022 before transitioning into how his taste for tunes connects to his career in defense.
Hi, my name is Mike Gruss, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Defense News and Military Times. I'm joined today by Colin Kahl, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy here at the Pentagon. So let's just start. The Department of Defense is not necessarily known for its musical exploits.
What?
Sure, there are the service hymns and the service bands, but there are also the hard-driving Metallica ripoffs that have appeared in recruiting commercials in years past. But toward the end of last year, you posted a tweet that listed your top 40 albums of 2022. And unless you're a certain type of music aficionado, you might not have heard of some of the artists on this list. So Soccer Mommy, Daywave, Big Thief might be a little bit unfamiliar to some of our podcast listeners, but also Lizzo, Beyonce, The Weeknd, Harry Styles. And so we're going to talk a little bit today about that list and your love of music and how that merges into your work with national security. A welcome to Colin Kahl. And I would imagine this is the first time the Undersecretary of Policy has put out a playlist.
At least since Doug Fife. No, actually, I don't know if Doug Fife put out a list.
So what made you want to do this?
Well, actually, it's a yearly tradition. It goes back, so it has nothing to do with my Pentagon tenure. No, I'm a music junkie. I have been my whole life, at least since the age of social media. Every year, for as far back as I can remember, I've put up a list on Facebook and Twitter. So it's just an annual tradition. And frankly, I post very infrequently on my personal social media accounts in this job. But when I do, it's often about music.
So tell me about an album on this list that you loved.
Well, you mentioned a bunch of them. My favorite album of the year, although it's hard to rank them, was this album by Soccer Mommy. And one of the things that I loved about it was I'm a product of the 80s. I was a high school student in the 80s, so most of my musical influences really originate there. I was really into post-punk and new wave music in the 1980s. But I was in college in the 1990s, and the sound of the early 1990s, that kind of garage band grunge sound, but there were also a bunch of just great female artists in the early 1990s. Liz Phair comes to mind, PJ Harvey, artists like that, and Soccer Mommy is very much in that tradition. Like, if you just kind of dropped that album, you know, from outer space and you were asked what decade it was produced in, you'd probably think it came out in about 1992. And so, I don't know, it just generated a lot of nostalgia for me, and she's had a number of albums now. I think this is her third, and they're all great.
I think the number two on your list was a kind of a co-number two.
Yeah.
Pete Yorn.
Yeah.
Who had some hits maybe 20 years ago or so. And then Daywave, which was a band I was not familiar with, but dug the sound there. So tell me a little bit about.
Yeah, the reason I put those two albums together, so Pete Yorn's album this year, or last year, I guess, Hawaii, and then Daywave's album, Past Life, I put them together. I cheated. I think they were technically at number three. I don't know if that counts as number three and number four. But it meant that my top 10 list could have 11. But essentially, Daywave produced the Pete Yorn album, and Daywave also produced the previous Pete Yorn album. And they were both released in March of last year. And March was a pretty hectic month for us here in the Pentagon, because obviously the war in Ukraine had just kicked off. And so I didn't have a lot of time to listen to music, but when I did, those two albums were really a bright spot. And they sound a lot alike, vocally not so much, but the instrumental arrangements, they both kind of have this indie pop chill quality to them. A lot of kind of hazy guitars, or hazy vocals and shimmering guitars. They're just great. But I really think it's worth listening to them as a pair.
I enjoyed them. You touched on something there, which is that so much of music is tied to memory.
Yeah.
And when you're listening to some of these albums on this list, does it feel like, oh, this, like you said, this Pete Yorn album came out in March, and that's when Russia invaded Ukraine, and those memories are linked? Is that
sometimes.
Is that one of the oddities?
I mean, I think it's an old cliche. I think that, like, you know, music is kind of the soundtrack to life. And actually, very much in my case, everybody's brain operates a little differently. I actually don't latch onto the lyrics of music very much. It's much more the musicality itself. But more than anything else, I mean, it's almost like a smell or a taste that can instantaneously, like, chemically transport you back to another time. And music totally has that effect on my brain. You know, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. I think there are probably songs I still listen to. I was like, oh, that was, you know, that reminds me of girlfriend I broke up with, right, and, you know, when I was 16 years old or something. So there's that type of thing. So, you know, I don't know that I connect anything on my music list to a particular geopolitical moment. And of course, I'm not, you know, I buy a lot of music and listen to a lot of music, but not always in kind of in real time. So thankfully, I don't associate a particular soundtrack with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mostly, I use music, honestly, as a kind of diversion from all of that. I don't have a lot of free time. I tend to work, you know, 12 or 14 hours a day, like a lot of folks in the national security space. And so music is something that just, you know, on the weekends or when I'm hanging out with my kids is kind of in the background in times when I'm trying to unplug my brain.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because I think even talking to folks in our office, when I said, oh, we're going to talk about Dr. Call's top 40 list, and they said, who has time to come up with 40 albums of the year? So how does that work? And someone asked me, does he know how to get Spotify on government computers? Does he know how to get Bandcamp on government computers? Yeah. Where do you find that time?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of it. So, right. I mean, my alarm goes off at 4:30 or 5 every morning. And that's mostly because I spend from about 5 to 6 every morning drinking a cup of coffee and trying to become a human being before I kind of engage my brain in work. So music is sometimes part of the early part of my day. It's sometimes part of the end of my day. It's more often a weekend experience I don't tend to drive myself into work, but on the weekends when I'm in the car. So it kind of fills all the space. Yeah, I don't know how I have time to listen to it either, but it seems to happen.
I understand you've DJed parties before.
And not recently. Don't let Secretary Austin know.
But that you also have a DJ name and that these are... The way it was described to me was more or less like national security parties, which people said there's national security parties.
Right, it's a little bit of an oxymoron.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it. I think people who know me understand that I'm kind of fractal layers of nerd. That is, I'm nerd all the way down.
I said aficionado earlier.
Nerd. So just all, I'm nerd in all the ways. So I'm obviously a policy wonk. I'm an academic. But I also a music nerd. No, when I was in college and graduate school, I, you know, would buy, you know, albums, CDs all the time. I have thousands of CDs, thousands of vinyl records, probably tens of thousands of digital tracks of one kind or another. You know, as an adult, I had the money for that. As a college student, a graduate student, I did not. So instead of going broke when I was in graduate school at Columbia University, I came up with the idea of subsidizing my music buying habits by DJing parties. And actually, interestingly enough, I finished writing my dissertation, even though I did my dissertation in New York at Columbia. I finished my last 2 years in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where my then girlfriend at the time was going to grad school. And I was broke and trying to finish my dissertation, so I started to DJ parties in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is ironic because I was an undergraduate student in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. And I think I probably went to more parties as a 27-year-old struggling graduate student trying to make pay for their music habit. So anyway, that just started that habit. And then when I took my first teaching job at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, I befriended a lot of the folks who ran the local vinyl record store called Let It Be Records. It doesn't exist anymore. But through the folks who ran that record shop, I started to occasionally moonlight as a DJ at some local lounges and places in Minneapolis. And so it just kind of evolved from there. But when I actually transitioned to being a real adult with real responsibilities in Washington, D.C., I didn't have a lot of time to do that. But I did periodically, you know, some think tank friend of mine had a book release party and I would DJ that, or somebody, you know, who's a close friend of mine got married or something, I would do that. So I think to the degree that there are kind of national security nerd parties. I have definitely done a couple of those. I recall, she'll probably hate me for revealing this, but Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, long before she was a congresswoman, she and I bonded over working on the Iraq problem set. And when I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, I remember flying directly back from a work trip to Baghdad, landing in Michigan and going out to Alyssa Slotkin's farm to DJ her wedding. So that's probably the first Baghdad to Michigan DJ connection.
I have this theory about D.C. that so many people view, quote unquote, the bureaucracy as cogs, and that you plug one person into a job, because of politics, sometimes that happens, but that another person can, not effortlessly, but move into that position, and that you just, people sometimes are just seen as, oh, I did that position, I did that position, I did that one. But in the process, and I think particularly with the national security press, people aren't seen as maybe individuals, or they don't have traits outside of, oh, he can drive for schedule, or he can drive for budget, or traits that you would associate maybe with a program manager. And so do you find that music is a way to help connect with your staff, or to help make progress on policy or some of these other issues? Or is it just, this is a separate part of my life that's kind of walled off?
I mean, I think there are definitely times in my life where music has helped me bond with, you know, staff members, perhaps if there's a generational divide. You know, we had a big debate in my office after I released the top 40 list that you referenced about why the Bad Bunny record wasn't on my top 40 list. And there was Well, it's a question. There's not really a good excuse other than the fact that my musical tastes go very deep in certain areas, kind of indie music and electronic music, and some slices of pop music. But my knowledge and exposure to Latin music is just not particularly high. And so while I did have the Rosalia album, for example, on my top 40 list, I did not have the Bad Bunny album, largely just because I didn't listen to it very much last year. I mean, I obviously heard songs on the radio. And so when I was putting together my own list at the end of the year, you know, I saw the Bad Bunny list on everybody's top 10 or 20 list. And I kind of felt like if I included it on mine, I'd be kind of trying to strike a pose that wasn't really true to myself. But it's a good album. But my special assistants gave me crap for it not being on my list. But except for those kind of bonding experiences that I have with members of my staff, generally I don't see music as connected to my work. It's mostly one of the vehicles I use to disconnect from work. And I find that it's easy for the brain to just keep cycling. And every once in a while, you need to think about something else or not think at all. And so music is a pretty safe escape.
One more music question. Then I wanted to talk a little bit about Ukraine, which is you went to Ukraine.
Yeah.
On the way there, will you listen to music?
Yeah, I mean, just in the sense that, I mean, you know, on the plane, like everybody else, pop my earbuds in and listen to music, but not.
Do you think specifically like, hey, I need to?
No, I think mostly, it's an interesting question. I don't really kind of program my music to like what I'm doing. It's kind of just whatever I'm listening to at the moment.
I feel like a lot of the messaging on Ukraine has has been shaped particularly by the first months and maybe even the first weeks of the war. You know, we'll hear a lot about not underestimating the Ukrainian people, which I think is true, but it's also something that became very abundantly clear the first weeks of the invasion. And I was wondering how you would describe the narrative and how that's changed maybe in the last 6 months. If the messaging were to start 6 months ago, how that might be different from where we were almost a year ago.
I think there are through lines. There are continuities. You know, one continuity is just, I think, people have serially underestimated the Ukrainians. I think they surprised the world. They shocked the world by how resilient they were at the outset. But they continue to weather just a brutal onslaught by the Russians. So at the beginning of the war, obviously all attention was focused on the attack on Kyiv. And, you know, but this winter, there's been a lot of attention on the kind of relentless Russian missile strikes and Iranian drone strikes on civilian critical infrastructure in Ukraine. It's clear that Vladimir Putin is trying to coerce and compel the Ukrainians by essentially trying to freeze tens of millions of people. It hasn't worked. The Ukrainians have held strong, and they've performed better than a lot of people expected. So I think one constant is that Ukraine should not be underestimated. I think another constant, which is highly related to that, is that at every stage of the conflict, Vladimir Putin has kind of serially miscalculated. Like, he presumed that he could roll in and conquer all of Ukraine in a matter of days or a handful of weeks, that, you know, essentially Ukraine wasn't a real country. Russian troops would be greeted as liberators. That was incorrect. He assumed that the free world would fracture and fly apart and kind of squabble with one another. And there was a degree to which that happened in 2014 when Russia illegally annexed Crimea and then started the separatist movement in the Donbass. Didn't happen this time. The free world didn't fly apart. It came together. NATO didn't weaken; it got stronger. The advanced democracies and economies of the Indo-Pacific rallied behind the advanced democracies and economies in Europe and North America to impose sanctions and export controls on Russia and to provide Ukraine security assistance. And so he is just kind of serially miscalculated. And so I think that's a through line. So there's some ways in which the stories that took shape at the beginning of the war can continue. Putin's a miscalculator. The Ukrainians continue to be underestimated. But I do think things have changed. I mean, the nature of the conflict has changed. And, you know, at the beginning of the war, it was about surging the Ukrainians the capabilities they needed in that moment to win the Battle of Kyiv. And so we were very focused on things like anti-armor systems, Javelin, most famously, but not exclusively, man-portable air defense systems like Stingers, other short-range air defense systems, providing them Soviet-era ammunition for their artillery and their other weapon systems, kind of culled from former Soviet satellite and former Eastern Bloc countries. And that surge of, drones and other equipment, that surge of capabilities really helped enable the Ukrainians defeat the Russians in the battle for Kyiv and drive them out. The second phase of the conflict shifted east, and it really became this grinding artillery duel. And it became very clear that Ukraine was going to essentially run out of their ability to use their Soviet legacy systems because there just wasn't enough ammunition to resupply those systems. So we rapidly shifted from to making a priority to provide the Ukrainians NATO standard artillery systems like M777 howitzers from the United States. We also, this was the point where we made the decision to give them the HIMARS systems and the guided multiple launch rockets systems, the precision guided munitions that are fired by those HIMARS systems. Other countries provided similar systems. And that allowed the Ukrainians not only to stay in the fight in the east when they could have otherwise been overwhelmed by Russian firepower, but eventually turn the tide on the Russians and set up successful offensives in the north in Kharkiv and then in the south in Kherson. We always knew that the winter was going to be tough, that as the weather got sloppy and then brutally cold, that both sides would be under a lot of pressure to try to rest and refit and get ready for the next fighting season. I think that the winter, the tempo of military operations has probably been at a higher level in the winter. And in part, that's because the Russians have made a decision to just throw bodies at the problem. They've mobilized tens of thousands of convicted prisoners to serve in Wagner's mercenary army in places like Bakhmut. There was the partial mobilization, very controversial in Russia, that mobilized 300,000 folks, very poorly trained. They don't want to be there. But Putin has just decided he doesn't care. He's going to throw bodies at the problem. And so this phase of the conflict has really been defined by the kind of brutal fight around places like Bakhmut and Soledar, where the Russians know that they can't qualitatively defeat the Ukrainians. So they're trying to just brute force their way through this problem while they're coming over the top with these missile strikes and Iranian drone strikes. So we've been focused on keeping the Ukrainians' air defenses active, helping them keep their energy grid alive, and then really trying to now surging the equipment they're going to need as things pick up in the spring and beyond to really kind of change the dynamic and the conflict. And that's why you've seen us not only give them high-profile air defense systems like the decision to give them Patriot, but obviously all the Bradley fighting vehicles, the Stryker infantry fighting vehicles, the decision on tanks. That's a really long way of saying there are these continuities across the conflict, but I think there are actually discernible phases, and in each phase, we've really tried to lean in to what the Ukrainians needed in that phase.
What do you think that phase looks like this spring?
You know, I think the real question is there's a bit of a race on. You know, I think that Putin is, you know, he's all in terms of trying to mobilize folks for the fight. It's an open question whether he will, be willing to do another significant mobilization at home to generate, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of forces. But even if he doesn't, he's obviously committing a lot of forces to the fight. They are, I think, running low on a lot of stuff. I think they're running low on ammunition. I think they're running low on standoff munitions. It's why they're turning to the likes of Iran and North Korea. It's why I think they will probably continue to press Beijing to try to provide more support. But I think there's just this sense that, you know, Putin has not backed off and he's going to continue to throw people and material at this conflict. And I think the Ukrainians understandably feel a lot of pressure to change that dynamic qualitatively, not quantitatively, to beat mass with the quality of the weapons and the training that they receive. And so we're really kind of leaning into that theory of the case through the provision of the types of systems I just mentioned a minute ago, but also in providing the Ukrainians some additional training so that they can fight more effectively, fight more efficiently, fight differently, and really kind of combine fire and maneuver in ways that change the dynamic on the front.
And those are some of the announcements we've seen in the last couple.
Yeah, that's right. And I just, you know, I think to the folks watching or listening, I think that any given decision we make, you know, can be, people might like it, they might not like it, but it's highly intentional. And the Secretary of Defense is really driving this. Nobody knows more about the conflict in Ukraine outside of Ukraine than Lloyd Austin. And he is really driving, and he wants to, and it's not just throwing stuff at them because there's a demand signal for it or because it's what, you know, Congress has asked for or the Ukrainians are demanding. It's what is the right thing at the right time? How can we provide it? How can they get trained on it? How is it sustained? How does it add up to something that really enables the Ukrainians to claw back more of their own territory?
Well, I wanted to ask a quick follow-up on that.
Sure.
Which is, I know yesterday President Biden was asked about F-16s and said no. Why wouldn't the F-16 fit for Ukraine in 6 months or in a year?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, first of all, I don't have anything to add to what the president said. I do think we are very focused on what the Ukrainians need right now and what is deliverable right now. And the reality is that fourth generation fighters, whether it's F-16s, F-15s, F-18s, or whatever, are not a near-term capability. You know, I think there will continue to be conversations about what the Ukrainian Air Force needs to look like in the medium term, and Ukrainians will have those conversations with us. They're going to have those conversations with our allies and partners, and that's good, and that should continue. Over time, the Ukrainians will, you know, probably need a more modern Air Force. But you know, if a decision was made tomorrow to provide them F-16s, this is not going to deliver a capability that can arrive, that can be trained on, and can be sustained in the type of time frame we're talking about. And by the way, we don't have unlimited resources either. Congress has been extraordinarily generous in giving us presidential drawdown authority and this USAI money, this Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative money, but the money is not infinite. And so the question then is, where is the dollar best spent? And right now, we are very focused on investing on air defense capabilities. That means, you know, Patriot. It also means NASAMS. We've gone to allies and partners for older systems like Hawk, Iris-T from the Germans, and other capabilities, but also the interceptors for those capabilities, and also the creative ways to keep the Soviet legacy systems that have actually operated pretty well in Ukraine alive and kicking. So, you know, if I'm going to spend a dollar on air defense, that's the dollar that we should be prioritizing at the moment. And by the way, it's also at the very top of the Ukrainian list. I mean, we talk to the Ukrainians every single day about what's at the top of their list, and at the very top of their list are these air defense assets. And then second are fires, artillery, you know, munitions for the HIMARS systems and other similar systems. And then, you know, I think number three right now is armored and mechanized systems, because they're really trying to build that combat power to break through Russian lines and change the dynamics. So we are going to continue to rack and stack those priorities, but I have no doubt that there will continue to be conversations around fourth generation aircraft. But I see that as more as a medium term set of conversations than a right now.
You described the invasion as kind of this war of brute force, particularly
the last couple of years, we've heard about future battlefields having to do with space and cyber capabilities. But there's been some discussion about the role of commercial satellite imagery, you know, with Maxar and Planet and others. But I think it's been less clear what role space and cyber have played in Ukraine in the last year. And I was wondering if you could shed any light on that and describe what role they're playing and how they may be assisting.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say this. You know, some of this stuff is pretty sensitive, so sure. I won't go into a lot of details, but I'll just say this. One of the ways in which the Ukrainians were underestimated, I think, by a lot of folks, and one of the ways in which Putin probably miscalculated, was in his belief that he could essentially decapitate the Ukrainian government, not only kill or capture its leadership, but cut off its ability to communicate with their forces on the front lines and with the rest of the world. Shut the internet down, prevent telecommunications. None of that has happened. And I think one of the major reasons that it hasn't happened is, well, first and foremost, because the Ukrainians have been quite innovative and ingenious, but they've also been really good at leveraging commercial technologies, not the least of which in space, to maintain the resiliency of their communications networks. And obviously, you know, Starlink has been very much in the news, and I think there's a lot that has to do with it. But I think in the cyber and space domains, they've made full use of commercial technologies. And look, nothing creates more Darwinian pressure than a war. And so things that might seem impossible in peacetime suddenly become possible in war.
What do you mean by that, from like an acquisition standpoint?
I just mean that I think they are moving faster than a normal bureaucracy would, because they are under intense pressure to, experiment with ways to either generate new capabilities or keep their capabilities online. And I just think, you know, it just happened that this war intersected with an explosion in commercial space, communications, imagery, all of that. But that doesn't mean inevitably that the Ukrainians would have leveraged that. Right, they still had to make the conscious decision and take a risk in leaning into those technologies, and they have, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for that.
Is there anything you can say specifically about cyber?
I will just say this. First, our cybercom professionals worked with the Ukrainians in the lead-up to the conflict. Obviously, we had pretty good intelligence about what the Russians were intending to do. We also suspected that part of that plan would be to go after Ukrainian critical infrastructure through cyber means, and also try to generate other battlefield effects using cyber. We invested a lot of time in the lead up to the war in partnering with the Ukrainians on thinking through how best to protect their networks, both so they would be more defensible, but also more resilient. I don't want to give us too much credit. I think the lion's share of the credit goes to the Ukrainians themselves. But I will say, you know, I think we did a lot in the lead up.
The National Defense Strategy has been out now.
Yeah.
Obviously something you spent a lot of time on.
Yeah.
What are the most tangible ways that you've seen it implemented in the last couple of months?
Because I think actually
feels very abstract.
It does. So a couple of things. First of all, we released the classified version to Congress almost a year ago, in March, I think, of last year. And then it wasn't until the fall, after the National Security Strategy was released, that we released the unclassified version. So we have been implementing the National Defense Strategy now for almost a year. In some ways, you're right. It does seem very theoretical, and frankly, I think there are some national defense strategies that, you know, it's a nice document, it reads well, it sounds smart, and it sits on a shelf. That is not the secretary's intent. In every single meeting that the secretary has with senior leadership, whether it's combatant commands or the service chiefs or the service secretaries or senior civilian leadership in the office of the Secretary of Defense or the Joint Staff, he pounds away at the fact that the NDS is our North Star, and that we actually have to implement it. And in fact, the implementation is not one thing. It's all the things. So every aspect of our budget is informed by the strategy. The choices we are making on the investments, what are we making big bets on? What do we think we should accept risk in divesting from? What types of research development are we investing in? What types of posture decisions are we making to prioritize the Indo-Pacific and Europe over other theaters, but then to actually build out that posture? How is that informing our planning for various contingencies? and how is all of that informing our defense diplomacy? I mean, as we speak, Secretary Austin is in the Indo-Pacific. He's meeting with our OK allies, and he's also going to the Philippines. And in the Philippines, you know, they're going to announce some pretty significant developments in terms of posture decisions in the Philippines. And I think that there's a lot of room to grow in that, because what we've really seen is, you know, in the last couple of years, a real sea change around the world among our allies, but especially in the Indo-Pacific, about changes in the environment. So you've seen Japan making historic decisions on increasing their defense budget and expanding U.S. posture in Japan. You're seeing, you know, what we're doing with the Australians, not only in terms of posture, but in terms of making the AUKUS agreement real. Put a lot of investments in the Quad so that we're doing more alongside not just Japan and Australia, but also India. We're doing things more trilaterally with the ROK and Japan. I mean, and now, like I said, I think we see a lot of opportunities in the Philippines. So all of that is informed by a theory, and that theory is in the national defense strategy about what our priorities are, how we're going to achieve them. The last point I will make is a lot of those theories are laced through a lot of the domains you asked about earlier. One of the things that the national defense strategy is very clear about is it identifies the PRC as our pacing challenge. But we've been China's pacing challenge probably since the late 1990s. And they have designed their entire concept of military modernization around trying to counter the United States. And we know how they intend to do that with their anti-access area denial capabilities. That's their use of air defense systems, their advanced air capabilities, how they're going to use space. We also know that they know that the American way of war is very network-centric, and so we expect them to come after us in space because our networks touch there. And in the cyber domain, we expect that they might come after our critical infrastructure here in the homeland. So we have built our approaches to domains like space and cyber around countering that theory. So if they think they're going to come after our networks, we're going to make sure that our networks are as hardened as possible and as resilient as possible. That's true in space. That's true in cyber. So that's just an example of how you take an assessment of what, you know, a competitor wants to do to you, and then you are very intentional about how you will counter those moves and the investments that flow from that.
You talked about the Philippines. I think there's been a lot of questions about Taiwan,
yeah,
and any kind of possible invasion there, including a memo supposedly this week from the head of Air Mobility Command. What kind of timeline do you think is reasonable there? I mean, I think we've seen folks say, hey, it could be 2 years, it could be 5 years, it could be 7 years, it could be longer. How do you think of that problem?
Yeah, I think the honest answer is nobody knows.
Right.
To include Xi Jinping, because I don't think that he's made a decision. I will tell you my view. I think that we can kind of spin up, like, is it 1 year? Is it 2 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? My view, I don't see anything that indicates that this thing is imminent in the next couple of years. And I'll tell you why. The PRC has been going through a breathtaking military modernization. And like I said, a lot of that modernization is oriented against countering the United States, especially our ability to project power into the first island chain in defense of our allies and partners. Obviously, they are trying to build the capability to coerce Taiwan. You saw elements of that in reaction to the Speaker Pelosi visit last year. They are investing in capabilities that might at some point enable an amphibious invasion of Taiwan. But all of that said, I see nothing that indicates that Xi Jinping believes his military is ready to do this. I think that they understand well that the United States continues to have pretty significant overmatch in a lot of critical domains, and that Xi Jinping would, all else being equal, like to resolve the Taiwan issue without having to resort to force, because especially after having seen the Russian experience in Ukraine. I mean, on paper, the Russians looked like the second best military in the world when they invaded Ukraine. They didn't look like that the day after they invaded Ukraine. They certainly don't look like that now. And, you know, the PRC has not fought a war since the 1970s. And the last time they fought, it didn't go so well. And nobody has fought the type of war that people are kind of wargaming around think tanks in Washington. So, you know, it's kind of like saying you got the two teams in the preseason that look like they should be in the Super Bowl, except one team has never played a single game, and the other team has been playing season after season after season for decades. I don't think the PRC leadership, you know, assesses this is possible, and I'm not sure that they've made any decision about whether it's even desirable. I think what we need to be mindful of is our deterrent capability is meaningful and real right now. But what the NDS says is that there's an imperative to sustain that edge and to strengthen it over time, and we are committed to doing that so that every single day our adversaries wake up and say today is not the day. And that's true tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that and the day after that. So we are committed, and I think we can put a lot more time on the clock. And in the interim, we owe it to the American people to not seek a conflict or confrontation, because it's not in our interest to have it either. It's not in the world's interest to have it. Nobody is seeking a confrontation with the PRC or anybody else. Our posture is to defend our allies and partners and to deter aggression. We do not want a conflict. The good news is I do not think a conflict is imminent unless we kind of stumble into one, and we will be very mindful to not let that happen.
There's been some foreshadowing of what the Secretary's announcement in the Philippines will be. We've seen the changes of rearranging forces in Okinawa, and that's kind of been viewed as maybe the first force posture change. Should we think of those kind of together, and are there more coming?
I think that in general, there's a recognition, and this is, you know, this was true of the previous administration coming out of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which is a very strong document, and in many ways, the 2022 National Defense Strategy, you know, kind of iterated and was the natural evolution from the 2018 document. But I think, you know, whether it's the last administration or the bipartisan consensus on the Hill, there's a notion that our posture across the Indo-Pacific needs to be more distributed. It needs to be more resilient. It needs to be more modern. It needs to be more lethal. And it's easy to kind of like put that on a PowerPoint slide right, or put it in a strategy document. Then you actually have to make it real.
With ships.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you make it real with stuff, but sometimes you make it real with how you are transforming yourself and then where those capabilities are placed. And so I think that the Japan announcements are indicative of all of those things, right? So we've had Marines on Okinawa for a long time, and we're transitioning to a different force posture on Okinawa. And there will be fewer Marines in Okinawa than there were, say, 10 years ago because of the agreements that were made a number of years ago. It's not the number. It's how they're composed. And the Marine Littoral Regiment that will be in Japan is especially constituted to be effective inside the first island chain. So this is about the Marines remaking themselves after a decade of counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan, to really reorient towards great power competition, in particular putting the Marine back in Marine and really orienting the naval and Marine elements of the Indo-Pacific in particular. And so I think that's just indicative of how we are trying to change ourselves and then implement those decisions alongside our allies and partners. But it only happens because our allies and partners are open to it. And they're open to it because they see the security environment rapidly changing around them. And I think that's what brings together dynamics you're seeing in Japan, dynamics you're seeing in Australia, potentially some of the mood music in the Philippines.
We've talked a lot about what to expect for the rest of this year. I wanted to go back to music. What's an album you're looking forward to this year?
Now, obviously, we're very early in 2023, so who knows? But some of the bands that I really enjoy that will have albums out soon, there's going to be a new album by The National. They're one of my favorite bands. New album by Gorillaz, a really good band. M83 will have a new album. And I'm really excited about the new album by Boy Genius. I don't know if you know this. This is Phoebe Bridgers and Lucy Dacus and Julianne Baker, who are three of the most amazing female singer songwriters out there, kind of in the indie universe, and they kind of came together like the Super Friends a number of years ago. I actually got to see them in concert in Oakland in between the Obama and Biden administrations. They're fantastic, so I'm really excited for the Boy Genius album. Lana Del Rey has a new album this year. I'm sure that'll be great. All her albums are great. So those are the kind of the things that I'm looking forward to when I'm not focusing on ensuring a strategic defeat for the Russians in Ukraine.
Great. Colin, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
That's it for us this morning. To get more of the top stories and breaking news, go to defensenews.com/EBB to subscribe to the Early Bird Brief newsletter. If you liked what you heard, give us a like wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media @defense_news and @military_times. The Early Bird Brief is hosted by me, Jonathan Lehrfeld, and produced by Zimon Z. Perez. If you liked our conversation today, be sure to check out our work across our various platforms. Also, please rate us and be sure to leave a comment on whatever platform you use. Our editor-in-chief is Mike Gruss. Have a great day.